Hello, welcome back to Railway Mania, episode 5. It's been 5 episodes already. Thank you everyone for your support so far. I hope you're enjoying it. This episode is the longest we've done yet, at over 1 hour 30. It's an in-depth topic that will possibly raise some temperatures, but I think it's a really interesting topic. I've got a great guest, Simon Martin, who is currently writing a book about the controversial engineer Edward Thompson, who succeeded Sir Nigel Gresley as the chief mechanical engineer of the London Northeastern Railway. I've always said that railway enthusiasts are a passionate people, and sometimes that can lead to partisan views where maybe we let our emotions get in the way of the facts. Simon is taking on the wide public perception of Edward Thompson in his new book, and aims to use new research material to cast Thompson in a different light. Simon, welcome to Railway Mania. We're going to be talking today about Edward Thompson, who was chief mechanical engineer.
Yeah, that's right.
Of the London Northeastern Railway during the war years, World War II.
Yes, so from 1941 up until his retirement at age 65 in 1946. And that's quite important because that was actually a rule the London Northeastern Railway had and would have applied to all of their chief mechanical engineers. In fact, all of the top executive board had to retire at age 65.
What was his background? How did he get to the job that we're going to be talking about today?
So the thing about Edward Thompson that you have to remember is that he was an engineer. Out and out, he had worked on the shop floor at a number of big railway works. He worked at Derby, he'd worked with the Northeastern Railway, he worked latterly at Stratford and Darlington and Doncaster. And throughout his career, most of his work was actually focused on maintaining locomotives and rolling stock. It was about what was going on the shop floor, how were they building it, what was making locomotives more reliable from one to another. And when he was working as one of Gresley's assistants, most of his work was actually with rebuilding older locomotives to new standards. So, for example, under Gresley, he rebuilt the Class A7. Round-top boiler, piston valves, quite more modern setup than what was there. This was one of Raven's locomotives, I should point out, that was rebuilt. And really, it was about ease of maintenance and ease of running. Throughout his life, that was what Thompson was really focused on. There were a couple of times where he assisted Gresley with certain designs. He and Bully had worked out the fitting of the double carve trap for the original W1, and then was later involved in a minor role in the rebuilding at Darlington Works.
So Bully, who, controversial figure in his own right,
absolutely,
also studied under Gresley.
Yes. So they were both Gresley's assistants. Thompson and Bully had actually worked together constantly. When you go and look at the LNER archives in Kew Gardens, there are copies of letters from Gresley to Thompson and Thompson to Gresley, Thompson to Peppercorn, Peppercorn to Gresley, Peppercorn to Thompson, and then Bullied, obviously, in the early years, is there as well. Then you have people like Robert Tom, G.A. Musgrave, who's a locomotive superintendent. You've got Bert Spencer, who was their conjugated valve gear specialist in terms of the design team. And then you have people like Windle, and he was one of the chief draftsmen. And when he was working under Thompson, he becomes a more important figure because quite a lot of the controversial stuff about Thompson has come from views that either he or Bert Spencer have expressed. Together with, and this is a name, Freddie Harrison, who you may remember worked on Duke of Gloucester in later years.
Mm-hmm. So Gresley, who everybody knows as the designer of the A3s and the A4s, he's coming up to retirement. The war is on at this point?
Yeah, the war is on. So, 1939, September 1939, the Second World War starts. The London Northeastern Railway instantly lose about 57,000 to 60,000 people from maintenance roles. And when we say maintenance roles, we're talking people who would work in the sheds, would be involved in things like greasing up conjugated valve gear, helping in oiling up around locomotives, which was nominally a driver's or fireman's job, but there were things that were slightly changed in terms of setup, especially during the early years of the war, in order to help locomotive availability. They also lost a shed load of foundry capacity. We're talking about the wartime executive. The wartime executive goes to the London Northeastern Railway and says, hey, we need your foundry capacity to build armaments. We need your factory space to build tanks, amphibious craft, so many different types of weaponry. And the LNER, together with the Southern, the Great Western, and the Midland, because let's not forget their role in the war effort, they give up so much of their space. When you actually look at what was available for locomotive rebuilding and maintenance and development, there wasn't much. We're talking about 90% of the foundry capacity was given over to armaments. That's huge. And that explains a lot of the decisions that were taken both by Gresley and Thompson in terms of fabricating and welding components instead of creating a casting, for example. Because actually, they didn't have the time, the space, or the materials to take away from the war effort.
If you've ever seen a photo of an armaments factory and you look at all the rows of shells everywhere, I think I read somewhere that in the First World War, Russia had used up their entire pre-war stockpile of shells within the first 3 months. So you're using them so quickly, you have to replace them quickly, and it's a lot of work.
And it's a lot of work for the railways, because obviously they're still involved in a day-to-day running of passenger services. They're still involved in big wartime efforts. So, for example, we've talked about munitions. There's also troop transport. There's vehicles. There's even aircraft. The London North Eastern Railway and Midland and Scottish Railway hold honours even, I think, on how many aircraft they transported by rail. It's a huge amount of work. And all of the major locomotive and rolling stock engineering facilities on all of these railways was given up to helping the war effort. So we get to 1941, and the war has been going on for 2 years. Within that two-year period, Gresley has produced one new steam locomotive design.
Which one was that one?
That was the V4, 262, a smaller kind of Green Arrow-esque loco. In reality, it has quite a lot more similar pieces to it with the V3 tank engine. It's effectively, in many ways, the tender engine version of that loco, but with a round-topped and wide firebox boiler. It was a brilliant piece of kit. There's absolutely no doubt in that whatsoever. I want to be on record for saying that, because quite a lot of the criticism I get and other people who talk about Thompson get is that we do this to denigrate Gresley's legacy, and that is so far from the truth.
Well, I mean, you couldn't have one without the other.
No, you couldn't. Absolutely not. Gresley informed Thompson's way of thinking, and Thompson affected Gresley's way of developing certain engines. When you look back at the records, you can actually see how much Thompson did to influence, for example, the development of the B-12s. Mm. So while he was at Stratford, he and his own assistant engineer, A.E. English, spent an entire summer building and then testing a mock wooden valve gear to work out the valve events for what would later become engine 8579, which incorporated a Sandringham-style boiler, which was Gresley's design, incorporated piston valves. It was a fantastic bit of kit. We've still got one today in the form of 8572.
So this was effectively a testbed for...
In 8579, they pretty much did everything that became the B12/3. They did it all in one engine, presented it to Gresley. It did a lot of testing. That's not really been on record. That's the weird thing. Quite a lot of the testing, not just with Thompson, but with Gresley and his other assistants. We know about what happened with the W1. We know how the P2, Cock of the North, went to France. We know, for example, that the dynamometer car was used behind all sorts of Pacifics and similar.
Well, this is a railway that was known for its experimental designs. Yeah.
But you don't hear about the testing that they did with the everyday stuff. Mm. And that's extraordinary, because actually it's a really untapped bit of their history, in my opinion. But the roundabout point is that Thompson thought things through. He tested things. He worked out ideas.
Methodical.
Absolutely. Very different to Gresley. Gresley would have ideas. They would go out to his assistants. His assistants would then help him to facilitate the overall vision. Broadly speaking, that's true of all the CMEs, but in terms of Gresley, it's more distinct because of how incredible some of the ideas were. The Bugatti front end on the A4, the thumbprint behind the chimney, the W1's casing and the use of a marine boiler.
And wind tunnel testing at
the
time.
Wind tunnel testing, absolutely, absolutely. It's not simple. It's not a simple thing. So you're in 1941. It's about April time. Sir Nigel Gresley has been ill for a very long time, probably at least 3 months, if not 6 months.
Do we know what was wrong with him?
We don't know the full exact details. I suspect the Gresley family would know more. They would be able to shed more light on it. But we know this mainly through looking at the emergency board notes that we have available, and I have behind me, and I've shown you the ridiculous amount.
200 pages.
So that's 200 pages in one folder of 8 folders. Going from these specific ones, 1941, all the way up to 1947. Gresley doesn't attend board meetings at this point. He normally does. He doesn't like to send deputies. He likes to be involved.
He's very hands-on.
Yes, absolutely. And he was so with the locomotive committee as well, where he chaired. Thompson and Peppercorn, and other times you would have, for example, Bulliard, when Bulliard was still at the LNER, would occasionally deputise. But these were really occasional things. This wasn't every month until we get to 1941. In a 3 week period, Sir Nigel Gresley passes away. And we've got the emergency board note 2823, which I'll read out. I think it's worth reading. It's a very difficult thing to read when it's one of your heroes. You suddenly feel so much closer to it, but I'll read it out. The chairman referred to the death, which occurred on the 5th of April, of Sir Herbert Nigel Gresley, CBE, and it was resolved that the board record with profound regret their sense of the great loss which the company had sustained by the death of Sir Nigel Gresley, who had been chief mechanical engineer to the company since its inception in 1923 and, for 11 years prior to that, had been locomotive, carriage and wagon superintendent to the Great Northern Railway. They desire to record also their high appreciation of his professional ability and skill and the valuable and efficient services rendered to the company. That the directors desire to convey to the members of Sir Nigel's family their heartfelt sympathy in their bereavement. So that is 5th of April.
You can almost imagine that being read out in the board meeting.
It was. It would have been read out in the board meeting.
Mm. Makes it very real.
Yes. And this is the next thing. This is the startling thing. So we mentioned Lord Stamp. We talked about...
So for the uninitiated, Lord Stamp worked for the London, Midland and Scottish Railways.
That's right. Yes. And he has also passed away in a similar time frame for completely different reasons.
Enemy action, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Which really brings home how close that was. No one in the Second World War was safe. When you think about the damage that London North Eastern Railway suffered, particularly in those early years, we have constant bombing by enemy action of railway lines, factories, stations, towns.
Well, you can go to the National Railway Museum today and there's a spot where a bomb landed and wiped out 2 locomotives.
That's right. One A4, Sir Ralph Wedgwood, and the B16, which... It's crazy. We always remember the A4,
yeah.
But we don't remember that we actually lost another valuable locomotive. And in both cases, potentially we lost members of their crews. We might have lost someone in the maintenance facility. And that's never mentioned. We focus on the locomotives. Mm. There's a very loco-centric viewpoint from railway historians. And I think that's quite sad because actually, when you look at it in the round, railway engineering is a very human thing. It's a very natural... it's a build-up of all different thoughts, and you have people with very different opinions on what to do, talking about what to do next.
And this all comes out in the board notes.
Absolutely. But this is the same set of board notes, and this is the interesting thing. There are many assertions in books that Edward Thompson was not the first choice for the London North Eastern Railway. Let me tell you how the London North Eastern Railway actually went about things. When they hired someone for these big executive positions or real, you know, engineering, high-level stuff, it would be raised at a board meeting as to, we have this position coming up and who do we want to approach? They would talk about how they would make the approach. They would ask for permission in certain cases, certain railways for this. This would all be recorded in the emergency board notes ad infinitum all the way back to 1923. That was what they did. They were a professional outfit. So when you have writers saying things like, oh, well, they approached Bulliard and he said no, or, oh, and they approached Bond and he said no, and, oh, they approached any number of people, maybe even Cox, got to mention.
He usually does.
Yes. Well, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's unhelpful because that's not based in reality. It is, in my opinion, a complete fabrication of what happened.
Do you think this is trying to weave a preconceived story into the facts?
100%. Absolutely 100%. And I only say this with hindsight now because I've gone through these board minutes at length and there is no indication that they have ever approached anyone other than Edward Thompson for the CME position. But the bit about this, so we've had Sir Nigel Gresley's obituary, effectively, in the LNER notes, and in the same meeting, one meeting, April, 3 weeks since his death, 2 weeks since his funeral, we then have this note. So this is the same meeting. This is within about a 20, 30 minute period. The board approved the proposal, set out in the memorandum, and resolved that, as from dates to be fixed by the chief general manager, a separate electrical engineering department be created under a chief electrical engineer, not subject to the control of the chief mechanical engineer. This was a big change. Electrics had always come under the chief mechanical engineer, so under Gresley. In the years that had passed, it was felt that there was not enough focus on the electrical development of the railway. Therefore, it would be better to set up a separate department.
And at the time, I think that they were all looking to electrify as soon as possible.
Yes, absolutely, which, in fairness, didn't really happen with the London North Eastern Railway. They electrified certain bits, but not the East Coast Main Line. And that made some sense, to be fair, because electrifying in the middle of a war, not really going to work.
It kind of cut everything short, like development of the Woodhead Line, hugely, everything else like that.
Hugely. There was no money. The LNER were the poorest of the four railways anyway, and there was never a lot of money.
Second largest, but
the poorest.
So less money to go over quite a large distance, yeah.
Yes. Mm. And fundamentally, you can see how much strain that put on the railway during the Second World War. So that's point one. Point two. Mr. Edward Thompson be appointed Chief Mechanical Engineer and his salary increased from £2,350 per annum with an allowance for war work at the rate of £250 per annum to £4,000 per annum with an allowance at the rate of £500 per annum for supervising government work. Okay? And that was the first board meeting after Gresley had passed away.
And it was immediately the next point they went on to.
Yes. There's no doubt in my mind that there is not any evidence to suggest that the LNER approached anyone other than Edward Thompson. And quite simply, it's because they had no idea what was going to happen in future. They recognised that they had an incredibly senior and, if I may say so without people laughing in the background, a talented man who actually understood most of the railway. It's very easy to say, oh, well, Bulliard this and Cox that and Sanny this, but Thompson actually did everything. He worked with rolling stock. He worked with locomotives. He looked at maintenance. He also did some time with track. He actually understood the wider railway so much better than anyone else at the time.
A holistic view.
Yeah, we would call it that now. And he was the most senior figure on the railway. So why has this story been allowed to develop when there is no evidence for it? That's the thing. I get that you might have whisperings amongst certain people, maybe certain people within certain departments in a railway, as to, oh, who's going to be hired, what are they going to do next? But the reality is that in April 1941, Gresley died, Thompson was hired straight away. That does not, to me, indicate a railway looking for someone else. That is a railway that has in place a plan to replace their chief mechanical engineer as expeditiously as possible because of the situation that is developing around them. This is not about in any way denigrating Gresley's work or what he was doing, but it was having a plan in place that they could carry forward with the minimal amount of disruption. Because let's face it, the amount of disruption they had around the LNER was great. If you wanted to put someone in at the top to do a job who knew the railway inside and out, I would argue there are very few people in the LNER, and particularly in the senior positions, that are as qualified as Edward Thompson was.
And this was a time when people would generally follow one career path through one specialisation.
It depends how far you want to go with it. I would say you'd start off in a field of engineering and you would develop and you would move around. And this was particularly true of Thompson and of Gresley and of all the major CMEs, even Ivatt over at the London, Midland, Scottish Railway, and you look at his career and how he moved from department to department, it's getting those hands-on experience. And Thompson had that in spades. He's 60 years old. He's been in most of the major departments of the London North Eastern Railway. He's worked with Gresley. He knows the setup. He even lives in Doncaster at this point. Why wouldn't you just hire him? And that's exactly what they did.
Why do you think people perceive Thompson to be a controversial figure?
They perceive Thompson to be a controversial figure, in my opinion, based on a very select few people who have written about him after the event and have perhaps been unfair in terms of their portrayal of him. In front of you, there's a model of Great Northern.
It's very pretty.
I think it's a great-looking loco. But it's mostly a Gresley design. And I say that, and can say that very confidently, because you can look at it and it is effectively a Gresley locomotive with a Thompson front end. It would not be unfair to say that this engine was the post-war A4 Pacific, because it has A4 Pacific frames with minor modifications. It has an A4 250-pound boiler. It has, effectively, a tender not unlike the A4 ones that had been rebuilt from the one that Great Northern was shocked with. There's very little of the original A1 on there. I think they used the centre driving wheels, parts of the Cartazzi setup, and the frames and wheels of the tender.
It's a heavy rebuild.
It is. It may be, in 1944, you could argue this was Thompson following Bulliard, in so much that they both were a little bit sly in how they managed to obtain certain orders for locomotives. So this was classed as a rebuild, but in reality, the old 4470, which was one of the A10s at that point, they'd reclassified A1s to A10 to make room for the new A1. But here we have it. We have Great Northern, built in and around 1944, comes out in September 1945, literally just at the end of hostilities. People have been working on the A1 design for a while. I think it's important because it's easy to get bogged down in the idea that Thompson hated everything that was Gresley. And that categorically, fundamentally, is untrue. There is no real evidence for that. What there is a significant disagreement on the merits, or otherwise, of the conjugated valve gear.
And, could we just give a quick outline as to what conjugated valve gear is to anybody who doesn't know?
So the London North Eastern Railway used three-cylinder locomotives. During Gresley's era, they used this particular setup called conjugated valve gear. Effectively, it is a bar across all three of the cylinders, which draws in the centre cylinder in a pin arrangement, which means you only have two Walshirt's valve gear on the outside cylinders. Your conjugated arrangement effectively allows you to have three cylinders without three sets of valve gear.
So the difference between that and Thompson's design is Thompson went for individual sets of valve gear.
Yes, but he also divided the drive.
So that means that the outside cylinder is driving the centre driving wheel,
yep.
The middle cylinder is driving the front driving wheel.
Absolutely.
So you've got to set the middle cylinder far forward.
Absolutely, spot on. And that means that Thompson's locomotives, by and large, have an elongated look to them. This was only on his Pacifics, because as we know, unlike Gresley, Thompson used two cylinders on everything else. And I think there's an argument that Thompson was abundantly right in that respect.
Well, Riddles did it.
Yep, Riddles did it. Stanier did it. The Great Western Railway did it and had been doing it for 50 years at that point. Probably 100 years, actually. More than that, longer than that. In the smallest locomotives and medium-sized engines, two cylinders is ample. Gresley disagreed. He produced many good locomotive classes with three cylinders. The point was, by 1942, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. You could have continued to build conjugated valve gear locomotives, which Thompson did, because he continued to build O2s and V2s because they'd been ordered and it was expedient to not cancel them. They were already in the process of building. Why would you cancel something that is already part finished? In terms of the V2s, the last four V2s came out as Pacifics with his front end arrangement. They were prototypes for what would have been a new mixed traffic class, which eventually became the A2/3.
So he developed the V2 design again, making it longer, larger.
Absolutely. It wasn't that much longer in reality. When you actually compare the V2 and the A2/1, it's something like 4 or 5 feet longer, because you've effectively moved the front bogey in order to accommodate the new cylinder position. But the reason Thompson did that was, I think, rooted in the experience everyone was having with the P2s. Because I think from the P2s stems all of Thompson's ideas about big engines. In 1942, the availability for the P2 locomotive class, bear in mind there are 6 members, is 57%. 57% of the year, the locomotives are actually available for work. They were meant to do around 70,000 miles between general overhauls. They, in fact, managed 34,000 on average. The number of days off for repair between the locos for that year was 803. 803. So 57% of the total days they could have actually been available, they were available for. That is poor. Extraordinarily bad. On the London North Eastern Railway, 57% was about 20% lower than any other of the big engine locomotive classes. So to give you some more context on this, the figures I have in front of me, the locomotives that were the most available for work were the Class A10s. The oldest Pacifics in the Scottish region were available for 76% of the time. That still doesn't sound great. That's 3/4 of the time available, but this was wartime. Every railway was struggling with maintenance and availability of locomotives, but the LNER were harder hit. And this is where all of the arguments about did Thompson do the right thing by rebuilding them really fall down. Because in 1943, the P2s, by now numbering 5 engines, their availability was less than half at 46%. They were achieving 25,000 miles where they should have been achieving 70,000.
That's not great.
In that time, they've had 3 crank axle failures as well.
So Thompson often comes under fire. This is where we're getting to with his engineering decisions and why people get quite emotional about this. Yes. So Thompson comes under fire quite a lot for rebuilding the P2s.
Yes, absolutely.
But if we're looking at the figures, then they're not doing great.
I think there is an argument that Thompson did the kindest thing with the P2s, which was rebuilding them. Because to be brutally honest, if that had been on any other railway with any other locomotive designers' locomotives, they would have been withdrawn and scrapped. The Great Western wouldn't have run them.
They were ruthless.
On the Southern Railway, Southern Region rather, when the bullied Merchant Navy class suffered a crank axle failure with Bigby Line, they withdrew all of them, plus the smaller engines, the West Country and the Battle of Britain locos, for examination and changed all the crank axles. That was one crank axle failure, okay? And literally took out of traffic 100 engines, for which Gresley V2s and Thompson B1s and Stanier Black 5s then took over the reins to look after the services. But during the war, the P2s suffered 3 major crank axle failures and continued to be run.
Desperate times.
Very desperate times. But the P2s actually were such a small, insignificant problem in the greater scheme of things. So, in that year, we have 46% availability for 1943. In the same year, Vane of Fife has been rebuilt. So I'll give you those figures again for the P2s. They average 25,357, okay? The highest mileage for any of those locos was around 26,000. Vane of Fife was available for more of the days that it was in service, 71% when it first comes out as a prototype. And it does 45,732 miles, which, to give you some further context, right, this is a new locomotive. The best A4s were achieving in and around 55,000 miles. So this is a prototype rebuilt from what is a fundamentally flawed locomotive design, is doing significantly better mileage. That's its first year. And we have, in the emergency board notes, a really extraordinary thing. Under the emergency board minute 3064 of the 23rd of July 1942, authority was given for the conversion of one P2 class 282 passenger tender engine to the 462 wheel arrangement. The converted engine has now been in service for some time, so this note has been written a couple of years after Vane of Fife has been rebuilt, and has proved entirely satisfactory in that it has not only been able to handle loads at least equal to the stipulated maximum load of the P2 class on the Edinburgh and Aberdeen section, but it has also been remarkably free from mechanical trouble so that it has been consistently available for traffic. It is proposed that the remaining five P2 class engines should be converted in a similar way to the 462 wheel arrangement at an estimated cost of £2,400 per engine.
How does that compare to a new build?
Building from scratch would be probably about £6,000 per engine.
Okay, so it's quite a lot less.
It's quite a lot less. The total cost for rebuilding them was £12,400. They rebuilt all six of the P2s, and they actually did pretty good work. If we go down and look at the availability figures again, so for 1944, we now have six A2/2s and one A2/1. The overall availability for the A22s, 57%, 26,000 miles average. Doesn't sound that much better than P2s. When you actually look at the figures and when they came into service, that actually starts to make more sense, because the availability figures are done annually. They literally go December to December, and the A2s were not coming out all at the same time. They were coming out one after the other.
So the figures are lower because they were still being built at that time?
Pretty much. The A2/1, the V2 rebuild, was 53%. We get to 1945. This, for me, is the acid test, because we're able to look at the A2s and the availability for A2/2, 72%. Availability for the A2/1, 68%. And they are as good, if not better, than the majority of the other Gresley classes. There's only one class that's doing better than them at this point. It is the 19 members of the A3 class in the western part of the LNER region. 75% availability.
Why do you think that was?
It's a big question. And I don't know. The Scottish engines for the big classes did better. The Western engines seemed to do better as well. They were smaller numbers of locos to deal with in those areas. It was where they were highly concentrated, in the bigger numbers of the classes, where their availability seemed to dip. I think we could talk about, maybe it was the water, maybe there was better quality water in the more north areas of the railway. It's a possibility, because the water quality in the south, particularly around London, is terrible.
It's very hard.
Yeah, it's awful. So that could be a factor. We could talk about, for example, how many people were available for maintenance. We could talk about what were the locomotive's duties. Were they as intense in the north as they were in the south? I think there's actually enough evidence to suggest that they were probably about on as even. All speeds had been reduced anyway during the Second World War.
We've talked a bit about what Thompson did in terms of the problems that he had to solve that were in front of him.
Mm.
Certain authors have put their own take on him. Why do you think they disliked him so much?
I think there's a combination of factors. So when Thompson put his design team together, his first thing was that he wanted to not use conjugated valve gear. In his opinion, conjugated valve gear was one of the source of problems that the LNER had.
Do you think you'd be looking at maintenance records to get that information?
Absolutely. And he had at his fingertips all these statistics. He was able to go into the works and physically look at what was happening and what was being done. In terms of conjugated valve gear, here is the disclaimer. There is nothing inherently wrong with conjugated valve gear, provided it is being maintained and maintained well. You gain more movement in the pins as it wears. It runs hot. There are lots of recorded instances where this has happened. During the Second World War, most of the locomotives that were three-cylinder were failing because of the middle big end. Now, whether you believe that's because it was due to the design of the marine type big end or because it was conjugated valve gear, you can base that on your opinion as an engineer. I don't have an opinion either way. All I know is that Thompson's view was that conjugated valve gear locomotives should not be continued to be made. But he also wanted to maintain most of the conjugated gear fleet. He created this booklet. He created this idea. The London North Eastern Railway should have 19 types of locomotive. Okay? 19. So he wanted 12 boiler types. Now ask me how many boiler types there were on the London North Eastern Railway when he took over.
Something awful.
163 different boiler types. How many different boiler types were there on the Great Western Railway?
Oh, very few.
Right, so we're talking around 20, aren't we? Of all of the railways, in 1939, the London North Eastern Railway had the highest number of different boiler types, the most number of different locomotive classes, and overall the oldest locomotive stock in the country, by far, to the extent that, and it's of some amusement to me to find it in the notes that I have for the availability figures, but there's a beautiful Northeastern Railway 440, the D17, and one of these was preserved during the war, but it was still included in the availability figures because it was still being used prior to preservation. And it actually skews the figures so much that I have considered removing it altogether because its availability was something like 17%.
So it should be in the museum at that point.
It should have been in the museum. It was then put into a museum, and there were two at the time. And the other one was scrapped. But that's what we're dealing with. We have, and let's be fair to Gresley and his designs, we've really centred on Gresley's locomotives. But the problem with the London North Eastern Railway was that it had lots of pre-grouping engines that were ageing, that were failing. We've picked out conjugated valve gear as not being the future, and that's fine. But Thompson's view was actually he wanted to get rid of all of the locomotives that weren't good enough.
And standardise. Well, he was big on standardisation.
Yeah, he basically wanted to follow what the Great Western Railway had done, which was to maintain a few very specific classes for very specific broad tasks. And that meant you could have a minimal set of spares in store for everything.
Which is more or less exactly what Stanyard did at the LMS.
It's what he tried to, absolutely. He succeeded by and large more than I think Thompson did on the LNER, only by virtue of the fact that by the time Thompson retires and Peppercorn takes over and British Railways is formed, the whole onus on the railway is actually that probably steam is going to die out anyway by about 1960. We've got the modernisation plan in the early 50s. As diesels are coming to the fray. But at the time, when Thompson was working, between 1941 and 1946, his thing was, the LNER does not have a good enough locomotive fleet to actually maintain the rate of progress and what it's actually doing on a day-to-day basis.
Could Thompson see them sort of hemorrhaging money and resources on maintaining such a disparate fleet?
They were hemorrhaging money and resources. So there's another interesting thing. Every so often, you'll get a letter is read out in the board minutes. So this is 27th of February 1942, and this kind of, I think, actually does give us an indication of how desperate the LNER were for locomotives.
And this is the height of the war
This is the height of the war. This is a letter from Thompson. This is to the Assistant Chief Mechanical Engineers at Doncaster, Cowlairs, Stratford, Darlington and Gorton, including CCing, effectively, the locomotive running superintendents at York, Gerrards Cross, Shenfield and Edinburgh. This is going across country. This is to the big heads of. This is a message to be sent out to everyone. And this is what Thompson says. I attach a copy of a letter which I have today addressed to the mechanical engineers. While the output from the works and the engines under repair there has remained at more or less a steady figure since the commencement of the year, the number of engines stopped awaiting repair has increased from 106 to 191. That is 1 month. We are 1 or 2 months in, effectively, and it's gone up by about 85 engines. And obviously, this condition cannot be allowed to continue. I therefore wish you to have a special examination made of every engine which you now have stopped at the sheds waiting to go to main works, and in conjunction with the special boiler examination reports which you will be receiving, see whether it is possible to return some of the engines to traffic for further service. If it will be of any assistance to you, I would be prepared forthwith to make it a permanent arrangement for the boiler of every engine which it is proposed to stop for general repair to be specially examined by a boiler inspector so as to form an opinion as to whether, so far as the boiler is concerned, there is any reason why the engine should not continue in service. These special examinations will only anticipate what will eventually be carried out as soon as the shopping of all engines is controlled from my headquarters office. I do hope that you are giving your personal attention and agreement before any engine is stopped for general repair, having in mind what I have previously stated at our recent meeting. And I'm sending a copy of this letter to the mechanical engineers. So, what do we get from that? He really wants you to be sure that your engine needs to go into the works for repair. That's the bottom line. The overall availability of London North Eastern Railway locomotives, and bear in mind this is only for 1942 because that's the only year I've completely finished the availability figures on, and to give context back to our listeners, We've talked about this availability figures document, which I've been going through and copying into an Excel spreadsheet and then making the figures available for anyone who wants to read them. So for 1942, the overall availability of LNER locomotives was 56%. That's across the board. That's all locomotive classes. And let's be fair, that's dreadful. That is just over half of the locomotives.
There's such a pressing need at the time.
Absolutely.
I mean, everything's going by rail at that time.
Absolutely.
And I was doing some research for another podcast, and during the war years, obviously you've got the U-boat threat.
Mm.
So all of those little coal ships that would go up and down the East Coast are now not able to do that.
Yep.
So everything has to go by rail. So you have these mega trains, constant use all the time. It's desperately needed. You're making steel all the time.
Absolutely. And what locomotives were doing the bulk of that work? War Department locomotives, the Gresley V2s were in there, Stania 8Fs. I don't think it's unfair to say that this is the most desperate time for London North Eastern Railway. The Second World War, they were at their worst and also at their best.
Well, it almost broke them.
I would say they were very close, very, very close in 1942 in particular, to not being able to meet the actions that had been set down to them by the war executives.
You can almost read the earnestness in Thompson's letter that you
Absolutely.
Just read.
Absolutely. And again, this is not a criticism of Gresley. Gresley was also trying to deal with this. He made similar mentions. He did similar things. Thompson and Gresley both found themselves in a situation that was very alien to them. Because bear in mind, the First World War, Gresley had been working for the Great Northern Railway. Thompson was in France. Thompson was at the front in the First World War. He was in charge of troop mobility and mobilisation. And it's very uncharted territory. They are both doing their best at various times to deal with a railway that is just getting bombed and is losing people left, right and centre. And it is such a difficult time. I think people, when they talk about Thompson and, oh, he wanted to rid the LNER of Gresley, they don't really take into account, actually, what he does.
He seems to have taken quite a pragmatic view to the situation.
I think so. So we've talked about things about Edward Thompson. So let me give you some quotations. These are things that have been written about him. Okay, you've got a book in front of you from H.C.B. Rogers. Okay, all the time, Thompson had at the back of his mind a determination to undermine Gresley's reputation. That was Rogers. He said that J.F. Harrison wrote this. This was in his book, Thompson and Peppercorn. I'm not wholly convinced that that's actually an accurate description of what was said. I say that because I don't believe that Rogers' book is very accurate in its interpretation of what went on. Now, there arose a new king that knew not Joseph. This is E.S. Cox in his book, Locomotive Panorama. E.S. Cox, for reference to our viewers, he wrote the report that Thompson then used to convince the LNER board to not use conjugated valve gear in new locomotive design. He physically wrote the report with Sir William Stanier and looked at all of the evidence that Thompson had given to them and all of the stats that other departments had given to them. And he wrote that they should not use conjugated valve gear. But that's the thing. When you actually read the report, Cox is very critical of how the conjugated valve gear works, what happens when it gets into a bad state. And the three recommendations he makes are that no new locomotives should be built with conjugated valve gear. Some locomotives that have conjugated valve gear should be experimentally rebuilt with three sets. And that all small and medium locomotives should in fact have two cylinders.
Which is exactly what they were doing on his railway.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Edward Thompson then went on to do. So it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Thompson asks for permission from the board to get a report on the status of the locomotive fleet.
From a rival railway company.
Absolutely. Stanier and Cox come along, they have a look, Cox writes a report, Cox provides the report, Thompson presents it to the board agree on how Thompson should go forward. Okay? There's a few different versions of this story. It was Thompson took on the job and said, no, I'm sorry, I will resign if you make me continue in the same vein as Gresley.
Dramatic.
Very dramatic. I'm not entirely sure it was true. I find it very difficult to believe that anyone in certainly the board level was unaware of the difficulties that they were having. I think what the report was actually about was Thompson kind of trying to give evidence that actually they needed to change certain aspects of how they went forward. And in the term in terms of the two-cylinder locomotives, he was proven abundantly right. But he was only following what every other CME had done for years. It was only on the London North Eastern Railway that new build locomotives, with the notable exception of the J39, had three cylinders. I mean, that surely says quite a lot. It was literally Gresley only doing three cylinders on the medium engines.
Controversially, is this an obsession of Gresley's, do you think?
I'm not sure I'd call it an obsession. It's a difference of engineering opinion. There is absolutely no doubt that three cylinders and conjugated valve gear was kinder to the track than a two-cylinder locomotive was. But by the time you get to World War II, track technology is catching up. Locomotives are better balanced. Two cylinders are mostly better looked after. So when he was originally developing his three-cylinder locomotives, you could say quite reasonably that his three-cylinder engines were probably smoother running and kinder to the track than the two-cylinder engines that were being built around the same time. But that was the 1900s. And when we get to 1939, 1941, the world has changed. Technology has moved on. Do we say that is a criticism of Gresley? No, because actually his locomotives, when well maintained, were perfectly capable locomotives. There's absolutely no doubt of that. But the issue was the maintenance regime wasn't available. It wasn't being followed. There wasn't the foundry and engineering capacity to continuously fix these engines.
I see.
Yeah, no problem. So I'll give you a few more quotes. This is a good one. A measure of his unpopularity was the fact that nobody attended his funeral. This is talking about Edward Thompson.
Harsh.
This was written by a writer in the Stevenson Locomotive Society journal. I've read it. I've got a copy of it now. It's very difficult to reconcile that with the knowledge that Thompson actually had as part of his express wishes when he passed away. Nobody was to attend his funeral. He was to have a mass in accordance with the rites of the established church, and that was it. You know, the two things don't marry up. It's an incredibly unkind thing to write about him, and yet when you look at the facts, it's not true. Further quotes. He conducted a Machiavellian campaign against all things Gresley. So who wrote that?
Tell me.
E.S. Cox. E.S. Cox, who wrote the report which undermined, effectively, the case for continuing the use of the conjugated valve gear. And then H.C.B. Rogers. This is a good one. Out of all of them, to the horror of everyone who had been connected with Doncaster, Thompson selected the pioneer of the A1 class Great Northern for rebuilding.
This is a really contentious point.
This is
everybody's favourite loco, apparently, that he selected to be his favourite loco.
Yes, which is bollocks. And it's bollocks because, actually, Thompson didn't pick Great Northern. Thompson asked for a A10 locomotive to be shopped, to be rebuilt. That is not the same as I'm going to pick Great Northern. Great Northern was picked by G.A. Musgrave. G.A. Musgrave was a locomotive superintendent. And quite simply, Great Northern had one of the lowest availability of the A10 class. It was in the shop, ready to be rebuilt and overhauled anyway. It had never been a good member of the class, if you look at it in the round, because it was the oldest, it was the prototype. It had the most amount of work that had been done to it. And the reality was, it was a very tired engine by 1943-44.
Something that I've noticed from reading accounts from engineers is that quite often they're actually quite dispassionate about which engine
absolutely
gets rebuilt.
Absolutely.
They don't have the same attachment that enthusiasts have.
Well, let's take Gresley, for example. Gresley rebuilt a lot of Ivart's engines. No one batted an eyelid. Stanier rebuilt quite a lot of locomotives. Chief mechanical engineers are dispassionate people. Engineers build things to run and to do a job. I don't think even Gresley was that passionate about his own locomotives. I think he was very fond of, say, Sir Nigel Gresley, but I think he probably cared less about Flying Scotsman in the 1940s, despite it having a 100-mile-an-hour record, despite it doing this and non-stop run that, and, you know, and rightly so, the locomotive was just another one of the A10 class at that point. I think he would move on from one locomotive project to another, because as far as he was concerned, he was always trying to build for the future of the railway. The way that the Great Northern story has been twisted, I think, is it's a really difficult thing to get your head around. Because if you accept that Thompson didn't pick the locomotive, then where does this story about, he specifically picked the engine come from? And it actually comes from Teddy Windle, who was the chief draftsman under Thompson. And I think it's been misinterpreted. Now, they say that Windle and Thompson argued, and I think that's probably true. There's probably a lot of truth in that. I think the actual argument was not about rebuilding the locomotive. I think it was about actually losing the name Great Northern. There's a theme with Thompson. Thompson doesn't like naming engines. When the B1s first started to come out and the prototype was coming out, he was asked for a name. They wanted a big PR thing. They wanted it to be given a name. And he suggested airily, oh, call it utility because it's, you know, part of our standardization thing. And I think that sums him up in a nutshell. He wasn't interested in the PR. He didn't look for the limelight. So the engine comes out and it's named Springbok because they had visiting people from South Africa at that time, and it seemed expedient to really make a big PR thing about it. Thompson apparently was furious. he just disliked the idea. He didn't like the idea of locomotives that were being built to do work being named.
That with Gresley, who was all about PR.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. But they were very different men. You're allowed to be different. The CME is allowed to plough his own furrow, you know. So we get to the P2 rebuilds, and all of them, bar none, come out without their names initially, and then the names are restored to them later on. And that says a lot. They were just jet black, any on the tender, numbers on the cabs. Fainter 5 eventually gets its nameplates back. And each of them come into service for a bit of time, and then eventually the names go back on.
Because he wasn't bothered by it.
He wasn't bothered. All of his A2/1s came out, completely unnamed. They got their names much later on to match up with the other P2s. So you got, for example, Highland Chieftain, Robert the Bruce, and Duke of Rothesay. These were names that were added because they had Scottish connections. The P2s had Scottish connections. Why not do that? But the point was, he wasn't bothered about naming steam locomotives.
So you don't think that it was out of spite that Great Northern was chosen at all?
No, Great Northern was chosen because it was expedient to pick the oldest member of the class that was already in works. I think the issue may have been that Thompson, not realising the feeling, the depth of feeling towards the name Great Northern, his thoughts may have been, well, we're going to put it out in jet black like the others and no name. We'll keep the number because it's for an accounting thing.
Presumably a lot of his staff came from the Great Northern Railway.
Quite a lot of them did. And I think actually he completely misinterpreted and didn't really understand what was going on. I think he remonstrated with Windle, no, it's not my choice. The locomotive's been picked, it's being rebuilt, etc., etc. And Dick Hardy was one of the people who was around and was actually helping to rebuild Great Northern at that point. He was a draftsman. He was working on the sanding gear for Great Northern. So he was around. He was in the drawing office. He says if Windle had actually remonstrated with him, Thompson would have just told him it wasn't my choice and that's the end of it. Because that's not how the CME works. People seem to think of the CME as having this almighty power over absolutely every single aspect of the railway. And the reality is that he is an artist with broad strokes. He's able to give you brush strokes that are very broad and tell you where to go and do stuff.
Well, that's it. And we describe something as a Gresley loco or a Thompson loco, but they didn't design every aspect of that locomotive.
Absolutely not.
They set out the baseline. That's what you've got to achieve.
Exactly.
And then the draftsmen and the engineers take on the rest.
The literal transcription of what Thompson did with the B1 was he went to his drafts team and said, I want a 6-foot 2-inch engine. We're going to use the Sandringham boiler or a development thereof. We're going to use these cylinders and use this valve gear. We're going to have this tender. We're going to use as many standard parts as possible. Also, because we have no foundry capacity, new axle boxes are going to be fabricated instead of cast. And he was doing as much as he possibly could to reduce the amount of work that they would do into building a locomotive. And that maybe was part of the flaws of later built locomotive like the L1s, where they could have really done with castings for the axle box liners, but in reality had fabricated ones, and that's where they fell down.
So that brings us on nicely to another point. So let's talk about some of his successes versus some of his failures. So
yes.
Some things that Thompson's criticised for are frame failures on his specifics. Could
All
you
of
talk
them
a bit about that?
But that's the maddest thing, right? And I don't believe that is true. There's a fundamental myth here that Thompson's locomotives suffered frame fractures and stresses more than any of the rest of them. When you actually go and look at the engine cards in York, when you look at what locomotives were shopped for, right, the Thompson Pacifics were in works more often than the peppercorn and gressy ones. That is an absolute fact. But their availability throughout the year was higher than those locomotive classes, with the exception of the peppercorn A1, which I think everyone could agree with me here was probably the best Pacific that the LNER produced. But, and this is the frustrating thing, it is a difference in approach. With the gressy Pacifics, they by and large achieved higher mileages between overhauls because they were run to failure. Thompson Pacifics had an entirely different regime, one you would call actually more preventative maintenance. So you have two different ideas on the same railway being applied. Locomotives, which are nominally more available for traffic but are not as good performing in maybe the extremes of performance. And then you have very high performance locomotives that are being run to failure. Which is better? It depends upon whether or not you're on the side of the driver in terms of the performance of a locomotive on a daily basis, or in terms of the shed fitter and the works for fixing locomotives and putting them back into service.
One of the other challenges levelled at Thompson is that in rebuilding the P2 class, he reduced their tractive effort and made them unable to do their original assigned duty.
But that's not what the records tell us. So I read out that piece from the LNER board earlier, and we have figures, and it actually shows that the A2s were more than capable of doing the work that was asked of them, equal to the P2s. The difference was, obviously, they had reduced adhesion from losing a set of driving wheels. But they never suffered a crank axle failure again. They didn't suffer overheating axle boxes again in that way. When you think about what happened the year before the P2s were even thought of being rebuilt, Thompson sent the W1 to work alongside them.
Was this the W1 in its original boiler form
rebuilt form?
So rebuilt it had an A4 form. Boiler at this point?
It was similar to an A4 boiler. It actually was probably closer to a P2, the 2006 boiler. In that respect, because it had the wider grate. You have to remember, the W1 is actually the most powerful express passenger locomotive at this point in the British Isles. It is the one with the highest tractive effort. It's a very powerful bit of kit. It is also a Pacific. It did the same amount of work that the P2s did, and it worked the same trains, and it did so satisfactorily.
Well, you're right. In essence, it is a Pacific.
4622.
Because it's got the two
that's
axles right
with
the back.
The, oh, God, I always get this wrong. It's a Bissell truck, I think it has at the rear. But the reason I'm calling it like a Pacific is because it, crucially, it has the same 6'8" driving wheels, has the same front bogey arrangement that the A4s had. And yes, it has the two rear trucks, effectively. But it is actually, when you look at a rebuilt P2, fundamentally, they're not that far different. They're not. They both have quite long wheelbases. It's just that one is a Pacific and one has an extra pair of trailing wheels. But ultimately, they both did the same work. There are lots of things that are alleged against the Thompson Pacifics. And one thing that is absolutely true is that they had more of a propensity to slip. But their rate of adhesion was better than the bullied Pacifics, and they also slipped heavily. I think it's quite a weird one. Thompson's reputation has preceded him. It has built up over a very long period of time with people saying increasingly more negative things and building up this picture of something that isn't necessarily true, both of the man and of his locomotives. Did Thompson Pacific slip? Yes. Did they slip more than other locomotives? Probably. But all Pacifics slip. That happens. Their rate of adhesion was better than the Bully Pacifics. They did good work. They continued and they worked up until the 1960s, most of them. You know, if they were so incapable as machines, all of them, that's A2/2, A2/1, A2/3, A1/1, if they were all so incapable, they were a very small group of locomotives, they would have been scrapped.
Just like the P2s.
Yeah, absolutely. But they weren't. They continued. They continued to do good work. Great Northern is the highest mileage Thompson Pacific. Best availability of any locomotive in Thompson's Pacific designs. Her availability figures, which we have for up to bits of the 1950s, and then when you look at her engine card and you work out what she was doing, where she was working, she was comparable to the best of the A4 Pacifics and probably not far off a Peppercorn A1. That's been misinterpreted a lot. People seem to think that the Thompson A1 Great Northern and the Peppercorn A1 are actually intrinsically linked by design. The truth of the matter is they're not linked at all. Thompson's front end was put onto the back end of an A4, right? That's what happened. That's what Great Northern is. The Peppercorn A1 is a development of the A2, of the Peppercorn A2. And the Peppercorn A2 is developed from Thompson's A2/3, which is first developed from the A2-2, which is the P2 rebuild. So Tornado, when you actually look at what they've done with the Prince of Wales loco, they've actually pretty much followed the development of line from P2 to A2-2 to A2-3 to A2 to A1. That is the development of the Peppercorn A1. It comes from the P2s. It doesn't come from Great Northern.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the P2 new build and Tornado are planned to share a boiler.
Well, they've now ordered two new boilers, so they'll have three identical boilers between them. Mm. Which is why whenever people say to me that, oh yeah, and Peppercorn developed the A1 from the A1-1 from Great Northern, that's wrong. That's inaccurate. The development of Great Northern was the final development of Gresley's A4 Pacific. That's in reality what it was. It didn't go any further.
Whereas the Peppercorn A1 is the final development of the P2.
Yes, I absolutely fundamentally believe that. I think you can look at the evidence and it is true. Because it follows through. When you look at the Peppercorn A2 and then the development of the A1, what you have got is a 6'8" A2 in many respects. That's the big difference. There is an argument that you didn't need Tornado in order to represent Peppercorn's lineage. But are we not very glad that we have it anyway?
Extremely glad. I mean, I was going to touch on this later, but it's... I think for us as preservationists, it's such a shame that more of Thompson's designs didn't survive. But then again, that's true of the entire LNER, is that so few of their locomotives actually survived scrapping.
Absolutely. It's incredible. So let's think about this. I've got the stats here for 1948. There were 6,500 locomotives in stock. Okay, so that's 1948, that's British Railways. New standard locomotives that were Thompson design, 640. Non-standard locomotives to be maintained, Gresley, 405 engines. Bear in mind, of that 640 engines that were Thompson, the vast majority of those over the next few years were B1s, because there were 409 B1s at any one time, 410 built total.
I think the B1 could definitely be called a success.
100%. The B1 was the locomotive that the LNER needed and had probably needed since 1923. For various reasons, a mixed traffic go anywhere 460, which was on the Great Western Railway and on the London, Midland, Scottish Railway and was in several forms on the Southern Railway, never materialised until Thompson took over. There's many reasons for that. Gresley always thought of building locomotives for lines, for very specific work. Thompson was, no, we need a small number of locomotives doing very broad roles and being able to go as far as possible anywhere over the system.
That, in a way, is indicative of their two different approaches.
Absolutely. But when you look at these stats and you think about 1948 and what locomotives are, so I've given you the Thompson and Gresley ones. So, Peppercorn engines, 134. Then, in other forms, you have Raven locomotives, non-standard to be maintained, 17 locos. 17, 1-7. Robinson locomotives, non-standard to be maintained, 453. Now, pre-grouping and grouping locos outside of the above groups. So the ones I've just given you were Thompson, Gresley, Raven, Robinson, Peppercorn engines, okay? The ones to be maintained. They had 4,646 pre-grouping engines still in 1948.
Staggering.
I mean, there were pre-grouping engines on all of the railways, but none more so than the LNER. 163 boiler types. 6,500 locos. It's extraordinary.
And you can see, whilst they started to make inroads into standardising that fleet, they're still nowhere near achieving it.
No, nowhere near. There is an argument, and I think it's a fair one, that Thompson didn't do a good enough job because actually the LNER didn't change significantly enough. I would say that's probably a fair point. I would also counter that with Thompson retired in 1946. Peppercorn had 2 years in which to really start making some inroads into doing this. He didn't do it. I would say there's lots of reasons why. I don't think he entirely disagreed with what Thompson was doing, which is why he continued to build B1s and L1s and O1s and a variation of Thompson's K1, which became his own K1 design. But again, you know, British Railways was on the horizon. What could Peppercorn do?
He had 2 years.
2 years. It's not a lot of time.
Mm.
So let's talk about these engines, actually. Here are the standard types that Thompson wanted to build. A new A1, we have Great Northern in front of us. A new A2, that became the A2/3. The B1, the K1, the O1, the L1, and the Q1, these are the Thompson designs. And then locomotives that are to be built or maintained, J11, which is Robinson design, J50, Gresley design. So that's the new standard types. So they would have variations thereof. These are the only ones that are going to be built from now on. Non-standard types to be maintained. This is the exhaustive list. These are the engines that Thompson wanted to keep in the LNER locomotive stock and to maintain. A10, which is the Pacific. A3, the bigger boilered Pacific. A4, B17, D49, B16, K3, V2, O4, V1, V3. Notice anything about that list?
There's not a lot on there.
There's not a lot on there because he only wanted 19 types. They're almost all Gresley. Hmm. There is one Robinson type, O4, and one Raven type, B16.
One could say the Robinson type is on there just for the sheer amount of them that were around.
That is precisely why. And that also allowed him to build O1s.
Because he was rebuilding the O4 into the O1.
That's right. And obviously the O4/8 where the cylinders were good enough to be maintained. So, you have all of these locomotive types that have been chosen. So 19 types. This is the number of locomotives that he actually worked on. This is what actually happened. And I'll give you the quotes to go with the stats. Very common quote. Thompson was determined to rid the LNER of Gresley. Okay. The total number of Gresley locomotives withdrawn under Edward Thompson between 1941 and 1946. Do you want to have a guess? Three locomotives. One of which was Sir Ralph Wedgwood from
which
bomb damage.
Blown up.
Two P1s, which were the 282 Mikados. They were entirely life expired.
And never really achieved their potential.
No. Which was a shame because I share Oliver Bullied's view that they're very handsome engines. They were possibly a missed opportunity by Gresley never to develop them further, and maybe Thompson could have done something with them. But by the time you're in 1945, they don't really fit anywhere. Boilers are life expired. Do you rebuild them or do you build a couple of O2s instead? You build a couple of O2s instead. Total number of Gresley locomotives rebuilt under Edward Thompson.
Well, certainly Great Northern's one.
Yeah.
P2s.
So that's seven so far. 20 locomotives. One A10, Great Northern. Six P2s. 10 B17s became B2s. One K3 became the K5. One K4 became the K1. And later K1/1. One D49, which became the D-class, the Morpeth. The Morpeth was unique in this list because actually all the rest of them were test beds, but the Morpeth was actually about, we've got a really good boiler on a locomotive that has unique rotary cam valve gear. We cannot get spares. It is frustrating the hell out of us. What have we got lying around? So they fitted Shire cylinders and valve gear. And it was never intended, I think, seriously, for that to be a prototype. It was literally a case of, we have a good boiler, we have a locomotive, we have a tender, what can we do to get it into traffic?
There's a real-life kitbash.
Yeah. And they put it together in about a month and a half, and it went out into traffic, and it did reasonable, but not brilliant work for the next 5-6 years.
That's amazing. I mean, the speed at which they were working in those days.
But that was because they put a plan together, and they said, we need to do this. This is something we need to do. I'm fairly confident that there was never any intention of rebuilding the D49s, and that probably is reflected in the fact that he wanted to maintain them. So the D-class was just a one-off. It was the unique oddball of that whole class.
To make the best use of a bag of bits they had.
Basically, more or less.
It shows the desperation of the times again.
It was war.
I think what a lot of people forget as well is that the war effectively ended in 1945, but the war conditions carried on for so much longer after that.
Hell yes.
It's austerity. Not like everything went back to normal afterwards.
No, God no. So, last couple of points on the technical stuff. Thompson was determined to rid the LNER of Gresley. So how many new locomotives were built to modified Gresley designs under Edward Thompson?
So we've got the A2...
That's it.
That's it.
A2/1. Four locomotives built using mostly V2 components. Total number of locomotives built to Gresley designs under the direction of Edward Thompson. This is Edward Thompson carrying forward orders and actually asking for more.
So this is like the V2s.
Yeah.
That they were already building.
V2s and O2s and a batch of Gresley J50s, which eventually didn't get built. But 66 V2s and then about 100 O2s. This is not a man who wanted to rid the LNER of Gresley. This is a man who had a different idea of what the railway should look like in 5 years' time, but was building a railway for now and maintaining it. If he really wanted to rid the LNER of Gresley, it was an impossible task because you've got so many locomotives, so many carriages and trucks and his logo and liveries. I actually think this is a man who wanted to maintain most of everything that Gresley had built up. There were finer points. He was an engineer. He had different views on things.
So your view is that he wanted to maintain the cream of what Gresley developed and get rid of the stuff which didn't work so well?
Yes, absolutely agree. So you had a couple more questions for me, I think.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Thompson's relation with his staff.
Yes.
What was he like to work with? Because it was a throwaway line in Cox's book, Locomotive Panorama, where he was talking about Aspinall. And how everyone was afraid of Aspinall. Mm. And you couldn't even look him in the eye because for fear of him turning to a rage. I don't think Thompson was like that.
Thompson is a character. I think you have to take it back a little bit. He was a soldier in the First World War. He saw things. He definitely did. He was not necessarily always at the front, but he saw the results of the front. I think that affected him greatly. He was mentioned in dispatches twice during the First World War, which is a monumental achievement. That's more than most men achieve in their lifetimes as soldiers. That probably says a lot about his character. He was very autocratic. That has to be said. He was incredibly autocratic. He had a way of doing things. There's a couple of stories that I think, and I will recount them very quickly, that I think will give you a measure of the character. They're working on the new Pacific, which turns out to be, I think it's Duke of Rothesay. It's one of the A2/1s, regardless. But this particular locomotive was being built, and it was being built with hinged discs. Thompson, very much about the details, was getting increasingly fed up with the number of lamps that were being mislaid or damaged. And he was of the opinion that actually they should have electric lighting and they should have foldable discs, discs that can be seen during the daytime and folded away at night when you would use the lights. Bear in mind, he's well ahead of the modernisation plan at this point. It's about 1943, I think, the A2/1s were being rebuilt. He comes into the workshop and he announces this plan and he shows them. And then one of his subordinates says, "I think it will foul the loading gauge, sir, on the top lamp bracket." And Thompson, who's already quite cross at this point. This is actually, I found out the timing, it's very similar to when his house was bombed and he was living out of his office with all of his suits. Just imagine this, you would walk into this office and just racks of suits everywhere. So never let it be said that Thompson wasn't a hardy individual. And Thompson gets cross and says, "Oh no, that's absolutely wrong. You know, we're going to go and find out. Find me a ladder." So they put a ladder up against the smoke box and Thompson climbs up it to the top of the smoke box. And he's muttering all the way. This is how the story is told. And the subordinate is quite, "Oh my God, what have I done? Why have I done this? I knew it was going to be something like this." So Thompson gets to the top with the disc and he pauses, plays around with it and looks at it. And he looks down and goes, "I think you may have a point." And he calms down. They go back to the ground. They discuss ways of refitting the disc mechanism. He didn't quite get it right because, as we know on the diesels, they hinge in the middle. Thompson had the disc hinge on the outside lip, so it was always a full disc and it folded flat forward, so it was always facing out. When in reality, if it had been a hinged disc in the middle, you'd save so much space. But this was wartime, and it was actually a good idea that was then carried forward in a different way by someone else. But Thompson was first. It's a weird thing. No one ever mentions that, but he was the first one to do that on British railways. So that's one story. Could he fly into a rage? Yes. Was he obstinate? Yes. Was he difficult? You then have to remember what he was like with his own subordinates. So with Richard Hardy, Dick Hardy, rather, he always recounted how good a person Thompson was. There are lots of stories about how Thompson would look after him in particular and look after the younger members of the railway. He personally allowed Hardy to have a footplate pass in order to look at locomotive design. There are many stories about good things that Thompson did. Even Freddie Harrison recounts that he had genuine acts of generosity. For example, coming back with a pipe one day for one of his assistants and smoking tobacco because he had seen it and realised it was the one that he liked. When he retired, he gave everyone a St. Christopher's medal that had worked on his team. These are not actions of a man who is entirely without, good
emotion,
humor and,
yeah.
Emotion. He's been kind of made out to be this ogre, this person who is constantly on people's backs and cracking the whip. And there are photographs in some of Peter Grafton's versions of his book where you see Thompson at parties and he appears, not unlike Gresley, to be the life and soul of it. And that is how he has been described at varying points. Because Thompson the man is not a one-dimensional Richard III Shakespearean kind of bad guy. He was human. He probably was incredibly flawed in a lot of ways. I think he and Gresley, actually, when you look at it in the round, they probably got on very well. Gresley's daughter was Thompson's was the flower girl for Gwendolyn, Thompson's wife. Gwendolyn Raven was Raven's daughter. Thompson and Raven didn't actually get on very well in terms of locomotive design anyway. Thompson is actually quoted as saying that, in not so many words, I am paraphrasing, but that Raven didn't know one end of a locomotive tender to front, or words to that effect. He was not particularly enamoured with Raven's engineering. He was more so enamoured with Gresley's. He just wanted to, I think, in what he perceived was refining it. This has been twisted over time to be wanting to destroy it, I think.
So a lot of people say that Peppercorn reversed a lot of Thompson's decisions. What's your point of view on that?
He didn't. So we have the two Pacific designs, right? And all that Peppercorn actually did on the two locomotive designs was to say, we're going to put the bogey back to where it should be, and on the centre connecting rod, we're going to change the length so that it's not equal length throughout the three, so that we need the centre cylinder so far forward. We're going to make it a more compact locomotive. It was effectively an identical boiler setup. It was effectively an identical Karlchat double chimney setup. The cylinders were virtually identical. The valve gear was in many respects taken straight from the various types, both Gresley and Thompson, that had happened before. The Peppercorn A1 has been described as the logical development of everything Gresley. I think that's unfair because actually, as we've described previously, Peppercorn A1 has its roots in Thompson as well, because without the Thompson A2 rebuild and then the A2/3, you do not get the Peppercorn A2, and you then definitely do not get the Peppercorn A1. Because that's all the Peppercorn A1 is. It's a 6-foot, 8-inch version of the A2.
And their relationship as people, is there anything written about that?
There is. There are some weird bits in the Colonel Rogers book where, understandably, because of the tone in which it is written, Thompson comes out not looking rosy at all, and Peppercorn doesn't come out looking too good either. And I think that there's one incident in there which really grinds my gears. And I'll tell you this one. So there was a letter complaining about Peppercorn that was sent to Thompson. And Thompson put that in his drawer in his desk, okay? And never showed Peppercorn the letter personally, right? Didn't talk to him about it. That is a fact. In Roger's book, there is a description whereby someone has gone in to Thompson's office and has retrieved the letter and then told Peppercorn about it. Now, that is described as Thompson being unfair to Peppercorn and being nasty to Peppercorn. I see that as Thompson sparing Peppercorn's blushes. And also, that's a really awful thing to write about Arthur Peppercorn as well. You're saying that he accepted someone else's point of view on this and that he would have thought less of Thompson for holding back the letter than telling him about it. I think that's actually, in Roger's case, it's a very skewed, very twisted version of the story.
Quite a partisan point of view.
Yeah, it is partisan. They did have a difficult, rocky relationship. And Dorothy Maver, bless her, when she was alive, I had a couple of conversations with her, and she was incredibly respectful to me for asking the question. But you could tell that Peppercorn and Thompson, it was a difficult relationship, and she very much disliked Thompson for the way that he lent on Peppercorn. I think Thompson actually trusted Arthur Peppercorn implicitly, which is why he went to him constantly. Thompson was also very lonely throughout the war years. His wife had also passed away. He had no children. He didn't have any immediate relatives within the vicinity of Doncaster Works. He lent on certain members of his group. Peppercorn was one. Peppercorn would get late night phone calls from Thompson thinking about the next engineering idea, and he wouldn't be able to get off the phone with him because he was his boss, you know.
You find that a lot with people who are quite lonely, is that they will focus on one specific item, in this case the engineering, to the exclusion of everything else.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think more than anything else, I don't think Thompson, in terms of how he treated Peppercorn, was treating Peppercorn, in his view, badly. I think Thompson just didn't understand. I think he had his blinkers on. He didn't understand about perception. He didn't understand about how he was perceived. He was thoughtless, probably, a lot of the time. I think he kept certain people close to him that he trusted implicitly. I think Peppercorn was one of them. And certain things have been maybe interpreted in ways that they shouldn't have been. But I can't say that he helped himself either. I think when you talk about Thompson, you have to remember that he was an older man, like Wresley, working in a very difficult time frame. They had a lot of similarities. Peppercorn and Thompson, both widowers, both lonely by the end of their working lives, both find themselves in an incredibly difficult situation. We have no idea of how difficult wartime is. None. We don't think about the austerity that was forced on. We talk about austerity today and we complain about austerity, what we have today is austerity in name only in certain respects. And what they had was real awful situations whereby you are effectively having to starve yourself because you have to make your food rations go further.
You have to think about every journey you're taking.
Yeah, every journey, every petrol coupon. You think about so many different things. And this stress is not just switch on, switch off, and you go to bed at night and you forget about it. No, it is constantly there because you have air raid sirens, you have bombing, you have reports. Edward Thompson going to all of these board meetings once or twice a month with the LNER Emergency Board. Every other month, there was someone else who had died. They would make a report about it. Not just Gresley, but Thompson, Peppercorn, everyone within Doncaster Works. They lost friends, they lost family, they lost their time, they lost money, they lost, you know, it was incredible what they lost. And Thompson lost his house. So while he's CME, this gentleman, his house is bombed. He was lucky not to be in it at the time. And he has to move into his office for a few weeks while they find him alternate accommodation. This is a 63-year-old man. That's extraordinary.
2 years from retirement made homeless.
Yeah.
let's talk about a bit about the scene today. What we've got to remember this engineer by.
Two locomotives.
Two. So that's a B1.
And another B1. And two B1s.
That's it. And a few coaches.
And a few coaches. And his coach design is actually really rather lovely. And this was one of the few things that he was more involved with than the locomotives. He really wanted to have the oval windows, for example, on the toilet ends of the coaches. That was a design point that he apparently, I say apparently because this is a second-hand account of the design process, this was something that he really wanted involved. He wanted them to look elegant. He wanted them to match what had gone before, which is why most of the ones that, bear in mind, they're still wooden framed coaches, but they have steel panelled sides. And in order to make them match the older coaches, they scumbled them, which is a form of painting which makes them look like tea coaches. And I think actually Thompson's coaches are some of the most elegant things to have come out of the London North Eastern Railway, maybe coaching stock generally. They were very good bits of kit and they were well respected, I think.
And modern.
And well, I think the Mark I was modern. I think Thompson's coaches were the go-between. They were the in-betweener sort of coach design, because at this point you have to make do with what you have. Steel is in better quantity than other things. Teak is difficult to get hold of. So you have wooden frames, which you can still get and still build, still bodies on them, and then you paint them up. And that makes a lot of sense, you know.
So you're saying that Thompson's coaches were effectively the stepping stone in between the wooden body stock of old and the Mark Ones.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say they directly contributed to the Mark One design. I think you could reasonably say that Stanier's designs contributed more. But the Thompson bogey type continued on under other vehicles. Even today, we see Thompson and Gresley bogies on the Pullmans that are pulled by locomotives like Clanline, for example, because they give better riding qualities, by and large. He didn't do much in terms of wagons because, to be frank, there wasn't much call for new wagon design. It was mostly about fixing and rebuilding wagons in order to be used for the war effort. He was more interested in reorganising the major locomotive and carriage and wagon works so that they were actually more efficient. The whole standardisation process was about making the LNER a more efficient railway, about not having to have so many different spares.
Were the coaches a part of that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The Thompson coaches are simplified in a lot of ways compared to the Gresley ones that preceded them. They were actually, this is the weirdest one, it all stemmed from the son of a diplomat being burned alive in a coach fire. That hit Thompson really hard. That was one of the first things that was coming up in his role as CME. And that's when they developed the Newton coach, which was the prototype coach for all of the ones which followed. It's a weird one. Thompson had very specific ideas on safety. That was one. So Thompson's coaches, by and large, didn't follow the same pattern that Gresley's ones had done, particularly in the interior, and in particularly in terms of fire retardant materials. They were much more Spartan inside. Still gorgeous coaches when you go in them, but much more Spartan. There was another event which is a bizarre one and explains why most of Thompson's Pacifics actually had a square-fronted cab. So during the war, one of the Gresley A4 Pacifics went through a water trough and passed another A4 at the same speed. Water came up from the water trough and smashed in a window on the what I think would have been the fireman's side of the other A4 Pacific, and it knocked out the glass and it killed the fireman instantly. And that was on the V-fronted front end. So they did a few experiments, and it was discovered that actually the frame design that had been used for the V-fronted front end was not quite as durable as the one that was used on the flat-fronted one. Thompson felt very strongly about this, and all of the A2 Frees and Great Northern had a flat-fronted cab for that reason. There is an argument that they could have beefed it up. I think that's a fair argument. They could have beefed up the frame, but Thompson felt very strongly that actually they should return to the front, the flat-fronted cab. And in retrospect, when you look at what he was trying to do, particularly with the original look of Great Northern with a smaller cab, they were trying to reduce the amount of material they were using for everything.
Austerity again.
Absolutely. The original Great Northern cab, its footprint is very similar to a B1 cab. I think that's deliberate. I don't think there's evidence to suggest that we know definitely that was deliberate, but it had a flat rear, flat floor, unlike the stepped floor that the other Pacifics had. So it kind of was a precursor and very similar to the standard Pacific cabs. It was then replaced with a standard LNER Pacific cab, but I think it's interesting that Thompson again was ahead of the curve there. And as you said to me earlier, the Ivett Pacifics, the last couple of the original Stanier designs that were then given roller bearings and square-fronted cabs, actually did very, very similar things to Thompson.
And the Caprotti Black Fives.
And the Caprotti Black Fives.
The last few that they made. They were very utilitarian in appearance.
Yes, absolutely.
As were Thompson's locos to an extent.
Absolutely. Well, the whole idea was access of everything, you know, being able to rebuild and build locomotives simply.
And that, I think, that design cue carried on through the standard classes.
I agree. I absolutely agree. So I'm not saying that Thompson is responsible for that, because that would be a ludicrous thing
to
say.
No. But I think that we've come from the 30s where design was everything, and there was a lot of form over function, perhaps, like, you know, covering up all the valve gear. And then we come into the 40s where utilitarianism is king.
Absolutely.
And the 50s, again, you still have rationing going on. Mm. So the design cues of the time were more utilitarian in appearance. And I think
absolutely
Thompson
agree.
Followed that. And I think he's criticised for that because he's come from Gresley, who is also obviously all about design.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, we're looking at the model of Great Northern that we have here now. And when you think about it in the round, people like Thompson Bulliard actually were recognising the same problem And that problem, as was actually, I can't take credit for this. This point was made on the National Preservation Forum by Tom, who works for the Bluebell Railway. They both recognised that there was going to be less opportunity for maintenance in future. The railway was changing, and that actually a change of approach was needed. For Thompson, it was, well, we're going to simplify it and we're going to put two cylinders on everything except the biggest classes. And with the biggest classes, we're going to make them have three sets of valve gear. That puts the onus on the driver and the fireman to oil around. And that means that, you know, they're very specific tasks and they're looked after. It's not split so much between fitters and drivers in terms of the conjugated valve gear locomotives, where you would have the drivers would oil around, but the fitters would actually work on the conjugated valve gear. And during the war, that was more difficult. Bulliard took a completely different approach, but with the same intention of reducing maintenance. So what he did was he encased the valve gear in an oil bath. And to be fair, it's genius. It's a great idea. Was it the best time to do it in? In retrospect, actually, maybe it was. And maybe it was in so much that you're allowed to try, and by and large, they did work.
One thing I want to close with is we have a new build A1 Peppercorn Pacific that's been in operation for several years, Tornado.
Yep.
There's a P2 under construction, a Gresley P2.
Yep.
There's a V4 planned.
Yep.
If Simon Martin could commission a new build Thompson locomotive, what would you go for?
It's right in front of you. I would have Great Northern. And the reason I would have Great Northern is because Great Northern is actually a super A4. It's weird. It gets such a bad rep, but when you look at the actual stats and the mileage and what it actually did and how many rail tours it was photographed on and what kind of work it was doing and where it moved around the country, it was actually probably a very nicely thought of locomotive that did good work, because effectively it's just a development of the A4. It's a prototype. People seem to think that you build a one-off locomotive and that it has to be absolutely perfect. But the W1 was a one-off prototype, wasn't perfect, was rebuilt and wasn't perfect after that either. There's nothing inherently wrong with the Thompson A1/1 either. It just suffered from being a one-off.
I think that the A1 Steam Locomotive Trust, building the P2, are looking to correct a lot of the faults that are inherent to that design.
They are. So the big one for the P2, and this is why I supported them, this is why I gave them money towards the frames, as a founder member. Number 103, which is quite nice. It's Flying Scotsman's wartime number.
Nice.
Basically, the big one was the crank axle. Now, Thompson didn't know this, Doncaster didn't know this, no one recognised this. The A3 crank axle that was used for the P2s was not beefed up enough. It wasn't good enough. It's actually unsurprising that almost all of the issues that the P2s had in terms of crank axle failure happened at slow speed, because that's when you put the most stresses on starting a train. So the crank axle would already be worn or damaged in some way, and then suddenly it would just snap at slow speed when starting. That's the end of that. They've beefed that up. I think it's something like another third. So it's probably over-engineered for what it is now to be used for. I have no problem with that. That's brilliant. The pony truck on the P2 actually very closely matches what happened to the V2s. But that design came from Thompson via Stania, because it is actually, in fact, a development of the Stania 8F pony truck. That pony truck was also used on the Thompson L1 and I think the K1s as well. It was the difference between the swing link and side bearer way of developing the pony truck effectively.
Can you tell us a little bit about your book and the presentations that you give?
So the presentations I give I've done two now. They've gone down pretty well. I haven't had any tomatoes thrown at me yet. There's always a first time. I'm giving another one to the Gresley Society in October, which I'm very grateful for. Mark Allett and Ian McCabe have organised that, and they have been very supportive of the work I've been doing. They've been very understanding with what I'm trying to do. The book I have been writing for 8 years, it's never quite finished. It's always changing. It's been changing constantly. Every time I find something new and it changes my view, I have to go back and rewrite it. Because the fundamental thing, without wishing to quote Churchill so much, is but as the facts change, so must I. And with the Thompson story, so much has changed my understanding by doing the research. If I hadn't gone to Kew Gardens and looked at the LNER archives, I would still be in the same mindset that the Thompson Pacifics were terrible locomotives. There was nothing good about them. But now we understand them so much better, massively. And I think they are very much underappreciated, and certainly quite a lot of fairly nasty things have been written about them and the designer that are untrue. And that's why the book has taken so long, because there's always something new to add. I'm actually come to an end of it now. I want to self-publish by September.
2019?
Yeah, 2019. I have had an offer to fully publish it, which I'm considering, and we'll see where that goes.
Excellent. So hopefully we'll see you back again here when the book comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to come back.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on Railway Mania. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. No, it's been really good fun. I'll just leave you with one thought then. Best thing that's been written on Edward Thompson. So Richard Hardy wrote this. This was in a letter to the Gresley Observer. If you choose to remember Edward Thompson for his work, judge him by his successes as you would Gresley. But I choose to remember him as a man of dignity, charm and kindness. He was not petty-minded. He may have been obstinate at times, but so was Gresley, for they were powerful men and were none the worse for that. Thompson could fly into a rage, so they say, and he was said to be difficult and unreasonable. His engineering ability has been questioned. Maybe he was a better administrator than an engineer. But so were some of the great names of the past, and there was no shame in that so long as they could pick their subordinates. 5 hard years, hellish wartime conditions, a good understanding of what was required for the present and for the future, some good engines, some also RANs too. A principled chief, a man of courage, remote perhaps, but respected throughout his huge department, which covered so many facets of engineering, respected by his superiors, not least his chairman, Sir Ronald Matthews. So now let Edward Thompson rest in peace, for he did his job.
Once again, many thanks to Simon for coming on Railway Mania. Hope to have you again soon. If you enjoyed that episode, please do let us know. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, we're on many forums as well as Facebook and Twitter. The handle is @RailwayManiaNet. If you haven't already, check out some of our other podcasts and videos on our YouTube channel and at railwaymania.net. On the website, there's also a contact form if you'd like to send in suggestions or if you've got any ideas or corrections. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more Railway Mania soon.